You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide by Free Speech TV. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman Program on more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. So glad to have you with us. Our telephone number, 866-987-THOM. A lot in the news today. Another hostage scenario is brewing. The Republicans want to hold victims of natural disasters hostages. We will get to that. The secret war is expanding. We're building bases for drone strikes around Africa and the Middle East. More on that in a few minutes. Representatives Donna Edwards and John Conyers want to roll back Citizens United. I'll share that information with you. Lamar Alexander, no longer the number three Republican in the Senate. What's going on with that? And Charlie Rangel is going to drop by a little later in this hour. In the next hour, Heather Sermo and Carol Swain are going to be on. We're going to be, it's going to be an interesting conversation about where the rights of parents begin and kids end with things like the HPV virus vaccine, which now Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann have brought into the highlight. But at this moment, there's a man sitting on death row in Georgia, and he's scheduled to be executed at 7 o'clock tonight. We have discussed this at considerable length on this program over the last few weeks. And Troy Davis. And I wanted to get on Mike Farrell. He's an author, activist, the author of Just Call Me Mike, A Journey from Actor to Activist. MikeFarrell.org is his website. He's been on the program before. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom.
And one of the most outspoken, or one of the more well-known and outspoken advocates against the death penalty in the United States. Mike, what's the current situation with Troy Davis?
As I understand it, Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, having not only turned him down, but having turned down the attorney's request for a reconsideration, there is no more legal step that can be taken. The governor of Georgia does not have the legal right to stop the execution. I frankly don't know if the lawyers have any strategy beyond waiting at this point. The family is, of course, devastated.
Yeah.
We
spoke yesterday, actually, Mike, with a fellow from Amnesty International who had put up the Facebook page, Justice for Troy Davis, and Amnesty USA, the president of Amnesty USA. And he said the one guy who might be able to do something is the prosecuting attorney in Savannah, Georgia, district attorney in Savannah, Georgia, who actually has the right to say, I'd like to, petition for a new trial or something. There are ways that this can be done, and they're making an attempt on that Facebook page, Justice for Troy Davis, to contact this district attorney. But it's such a long shot.
It is, and my understanding now is that he has said he does not have the right to do that.
Uh-huh, okay. Okay, then my information was a day old.
Yeah, the abolition community, of course, is trying everything it can. The people who are concerned about the situation in Georgia are doing everything they can. I have an understanding that a significant number of legislators from Georgia asked the members of the staff, the guards and the killing team and the warden, to simply not show up for work today.
Yes, there was a call for a strike.
Yeah. That's a demonstration of how extraordinarily broad the support is for the stopping of this execution, but two, the kind of mechanical, heartless nature of the system, and that we have run out of options in terms of stopping the killing of a potentially innocent man.
What we have, Mike Farrell, in this country now is a machine that kills people.
Yes,
and relentlessly, the one hearing that Troy Davis did was granted by the Supreme Court. He had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was innocent.
Yeah.
And, you know, the exact opposite of the standard for justice in the United States.
Exactly. It stands justice on its head. The whole concept of once one is convicted, one has to prove his innocence, which is, you know, like proving a negative in so many instances, an impossible thing to do. But when you have now 10 witnesses stepping up saying they had been coerced by the police to make a statement incriminating Davis, and 8 of them saying that there was another man, one of the accusing witnesses, who was actually the perpetrator. If that's not evidence enough to turn a court around, I don't understand what is.
Yeah, I'm baffled by this thing. It's and I think the entire world is. I mean, you even have, you know, the Pope has weighed in on this.
Yeah, and President Carter and any number of the former Attorney General. The hideous nature of this. I think what this does, and I pray to God it's not at Troy Davis's life. At the cost of Troy Davis's life, but what I think this does is fully and completely expose to the American people the hideous and inhumane nature of this process. We are among a few of the nations we hold in contempt for their human rights violations by continuing this practice, and I think there is no reasonable understanding that suggests we are justified in doing so.
Mike, we're talking with Mike Farrell, the actor, activist, author of Just Call Me Mike, MikeFarrell.org, his website. Mike, the anti-death penalty movement up until the 1980s used to be called the Right to Life movement, and that name got hijacked and yes. or taken or whatever, you know, more publicity. But it really is a right to life movement. It's the idea that the state should be involved in killing when the first law is thou shalt not kill.
Right.
And, you know, set aside religion. I mean, just the first human moral imperative of every society. You know, regardless of you know where you find them on Earth or anything. I mean, it's thou shalt not kill.
Absolutely, and the fundamental human right is the right to life.
Yeah,
for a government to arrogate to itself the right to take that is astonishingly arrogant and in some contexts incomprehensible.
So we have, correct me if I'm wrong, 34 states that still execute people, or is it?
It is 34.
34.
If my organization has its way, we're going to put an issue on the ballot here in California, and we will hopefully make it 33. Next year.
Okay, and your organization is what? I'm sorry, I didn't mention...
That's all right. Death Penalty Focus is an organization I chair. We operate internationally, but we are based in California, so our focus has been on ending the use of the death penalty in California, which we see as a bellwether state for ending it in this country.
Okay, Death Penalty...
Focus.
Focus. And the website is?
www.deathpenalty.org.
Okay. Well, that's very easy to remember, deathpenalty.org.
Right.
Okay. And you know, we'll get that up on our website as well with a link to it so that people can easily find that.
Thank you, Tom.
This could be, we have just a minute left, Mike Farrell. This could be, assuming, you know, God forbid, but assuming that there is no strike by the people of the prison and this execution goes forward, this could be a galvanizing moment.
I think you're right. I think we've now seen, I think it's over 1 million people having from all over the world signing petitions calling for the end of this execution. And I think that it's the worst case scenario. We never want to see another innocent person killed in this country. We never want to see another person guilty or not executed in this country when we can put people in prison for the rest of their natural lives without the possibility of parole. We demean ourselves in this process, and if it is at the cost of Troy Davis's life, then so be it. But it is absolutely untenable, it seems to me, that we should have to pay this price.
Yeah, so well said. Mike Farrell, deathpenalty.org, Death Penalty Focus's website. Check it out. And, Mike, thanks so much for being with us today and for the great work you're doing. Keep it up. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So I got to tell you about this hostage crisis that the Republicans are planning, and your calls, your thoughts on the death penalty and Troy Davis, and more. Brad.
When the judge, he still want me dead. There was no physical weapon, no murder evidence, no appeal, no clemency. The judge said, well, for killing, though I'm worthy to believe in God. Well, hear me, oh, and Biden's and Burroughs, no one ever seems to know. It's just a black hole of expediency, but I'm about to be killed by the state of Georgia.
Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, 21 minutes past the hour, and there's this incredible hostage-taking situation going on down in Washington, D.C. The natural disasters that we've had so far this year, most of them, by the way, that you can track back to the fact that there's 5% more moisture in the atmosphere right now than there was 25 years ago, 30 years ago, as a result of all this carbon dioxide, all these greenhouse gases. That 5% extra moisture, you know, at water vapor itself is a greenhouse gas. And the main thing is, not only is it exacerbating the warming, but it's also increasing the violence and the breadth of these storms, whether it's hurricanes coming up the East Coast, whether it's mile-wide tornadoes coming across the Midwest, taking out Joplin, Missouri, whether it's the flooding and hitting the state of Vermont and taking out roads. Bernie Sanders told a great story by the way over the weekend. We were both speaking at the Fighting Bob Fest, and he said he was in, I forget the name of the town that he might not have even mentioned it, but anyhow, he was in some little town in Vermont. And he was with the mayor, and they were showing them, you know, where a road and some of the infrastructure got washed out by the flood. And the guy lifts up a piece of pipe, and he says, "This piece of pipe is what's been supplying the city with the water, and we have to replace it now." He said the last guy who put this pipe in, after he designed and forged the pipe and installed it, went off to work as an engineer, a mechanical engineer, in the war. And Bernie said, "Oh, really? Which war?" And the guy said, "The Civil War." That's the state of our infrastructure in the United States. I mean, basically, Reagan stopped building anything, and we haven't built anything in 30 years. And much of our infrastructure is not 20th century, it's 19th century, from the 1800s. Oh, but we can't spend money on infrastructure. That might create some jobs. And if you create some jobs, you might get the unemployment level down. If you get the unemployment level down, then you might end up with President Obama getting reelected. Clip number 7 here, Jacob. Senator Dick Durbin lays this out. And then I'll give you the details of this hostage crisis that's being played out from this.
It's pretty easy for the Republicans to stay on message when the message is do nothing and protect millionaires. Did you hear the latest? A letter from the Republican leaders of the House and Senate to the Federal Reserve Board instructing them not to take any action to lower interest rates in the next 2 days. That is, as one former commissioner said, outrageous and indefensible.
So here's the bottom line. A, the Republicans want to make sure that the economy is as bad as imaginable. As bad as conceivable, even worse than that, inconceivably bad. They want to make sure that the economy absolutely sucks in November of 2012 so that they can blame it on President Obama. And in fact, there's a new poll out showing that more and more Americans are blaming the economy on President Obama. So they think they can beat him on that politically, particularly if they get somebody like Mitt Romney who can claim, "Oh, I'm a businessman. I know how the economy works." Or they can get somebody like Rick Perry who can say, "I created more Taco Bell job or minimum wage jobs in the state of Texas than all the other states combined," which is true if you're a big fan of minimum wage jobs. As Jim Hightower said over the weekend, jobs aren't the issue. Slaves have jobs. It's good paying jobs. But in any case, the Republicans have two pieces to the strategy. One, which leads us to this hostage taking that I keep referring to. I'm going to lay out the details for you. One is make the economy suck, which means don't spend any money. Even if that money means rebuilding what got washed out in the floods in the Northeast, rebuilding the town of Joplin, Missouri, rebuilding the damage along the Gulf Coast, rebuilding, fill in the blank from natural disasters. even if it means, you know, dealing, you know, rebuilding things that were taken out by the wildfires in New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas. Don't spend a penny on any of that, or very, very little. And secondly, don't spend that money because the Republican theory that they want Americans to buy is that the reason why you have to have small government is because government can't do anything well. Government is incompetent. This is why they hate Social Security. Social Security has never missed a check in 75 years. 76 years now. Never missed a check. So the hostage taking that's going on is we have about $36 billion worth of damage from natural disasters so far this year. And FEMA and other agencies need to, you know, are in there, but they're running out of money. And local, you know, cities, counties, states are asking for federal aid. They've been declared disaster areas, but Congress has to appropriate the money. So the Senate has this omnibus reconciliation bill, this giant spending bill to fund the entire government. And they have a little over $6 billion for disaster aid in there. And in the House, the Republicans are saying they're not going to go over $3 billion, $3.5 billion at the most. And they may well be willing to shut down the government over it because they don't want that extra $3 billion going out there for disaster relief, because that will put people to work rebuilding those roads and rebuilding those sewer systems and rebuilding those towns and communities. And when those people go to work, unemployment will go down. It'll blow up their political strategy, their election year strategy. So watch this. The next hostage crisis is going to be about that. So that, Troy Davis, and more right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Charlie Rangel is going to be with us in a few minutes. But also, I've got to share with you what's going on with the secret war. And we're building a new prison. I'll tell you about that.
Is it evil that makes men such killers? Some race or religion we hate? Is it the rich and the poor locked in a war? Is it fear? Is it rage? Is it faith?
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Our crazy alert for the day on Cloud 9. Space icon Buzz Aldrin has somehow stepped into a sex scandal. The 81-year-old former astronaut, who was the second man ever to step foot on the moon, recently started a new fling with a woman 30 years his junior. The only problem, Buzz has been married to a different woman for more than 20 years. Despite that, Buzz has been seen making out like teenagers with his new girlfriend, and his wife is giving interviews claiming that Buzz is just having a midlife crisis at the age of 81. Unclear what prompted Buzz's infidelities, but maybe he just wants to join the 250,000-mile-high club. But maybe not. Okay, I told you I was going to tell you that we're building a new prison. This is how with a joke, there's the joke and then the rest of the joke. Glenn Greenwald reporting this over at Salon.com. If you go to fedbizops.gov, this is the website where the government is trying to privatize everything. They are looking for bids to build a prison at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. We're going to spend between $25 million and $100 million building a prison, while in the U.S. our prisons are so overcrowded that in California the Supreme Court said this is cruel and inhuman, and you have to let some of these people out. And speaking of cruel and inhuman, of course, we have this execution of Troy Davis scheduled for tonight. If you want to share thoughts on that, feel free to give us a call now, 866-987-THOM as well. But this just blows my mind. I mean, you know, we're imprisoning more people in this country. I think I told you this story over the weekend when I flew out to Madison for the Fighting Bob Fest. As I was coming down the escalator, entering Reagan National Airport, you know, the downtown airport here in Washington, D.C., that diplomats and visitors from all over the planet fly in and out of, there was this giant poster. In fact, if Louise hasn't put it up on our website yet, I'm sure she will now that I'm mentioning it, this giant billboard. It was a poster. It was like, you know, 10 feet across and 20 feet tall. And it was the entire wall that, as you're going down the escalator, is the only thing right in front of your face. And it said, "Welcome to the USA." And there was a big picture of the Statue of Liberty. And it said, "Welcome to the USA, home of 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners." It's from the NAACP, as I recall. Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Larry in Messina, California. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on the whole idea that there can be even a contest in this election in 2012 when the Republicans have, in fact, ran us into a ditch. Talk about taking the social network, safety net from us. And still, there are Republicans winning elections, and people seemingly have questions about what to do.
Right.
I do want your comment to help me think this through, honestly. It makes absolutely no sense. When you sit back and look at it and listen to you and others, it really makes no sense that the voters are even considering giving these people, the Republican Party, another chance at running this.
Right.
I can't see it.
Well, first of all, we're 14 months out. And even 1 month is an eternity in a political campaign. It's, you know, political campaigns have turned in a month or two so many times in our history. So, I wouldn't count anything out. I think that if the Democratic Party can get its messaging together, which it has not done successfully over the last couple of years, and if they can point out the successes that they had when they had the House, that Nancy Pelosi had some incredibly successful legislation, much of which was blocked by Republicans or, for that matter, recalcitrant Democrats in the Senate, but very often Republicans in the Senate. If they can make that case, if they can build that case that the Republicans are the party of no, then I think that this is going to be a no-brainer. If they can play the Harry Truman card. The question is if they get their messaging together. Ron Suskind's book that's out now, I haven't read the book yet. Sam, one of the people who works on our show, was reading it yesterday afternoon. I heard part of Terry Gross's interview with Ron Suskind yesterday. And it looks like, Tim Geithner was actually sabotaging the president. The president wanted to break up Citibank, and Geithner, and he told Geithner, put together a plan to do this. And then, a few weeks later came back and said, "Where's the plan?" And Geithner, and basically Geithner was like, "Hey, I'm the Treasury Secretary. I know this stuff. You don't know this stuff. You're just a former senator." The conversation didn't quite go like that, but that was the behavior, insubordination. And, is it possible? In fact, the comment Sam made to me, he said, I'm reading this book in the hopes that I'm finding out that Obama is the guy that we always hoped he was, and he simply surrounded himself by incompetence and screw-ups. And we'll see. But, I think that you've got a very, very messy economy, and you've got a Republican Party that, as Mitch McConnell said, is committed to making Obama a one-term president. So, Larry, that's the bottom line, in my opinion. Ray in Massachusetts. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, two things I wanted to talk to you about was regarding Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. 1 million more kids are insured now due to Obamacare and having the parents being able to keep them on their own personal health insurance rolls.
Right, but how many American voters know that?
That's
5%? I mean, that was my point about the messaging of the Democratic Party. Starting at the end of this year, you're going to see health insurance bills actually go down, and health insurance and the quality of health insurance coverage go up, because starting January 1st, the health insurance companies are required to spend 80% of the money that they take in on actually caring for people, on actually paying for health care. And, because right now they're spending 60%, 70%, and the rest is going to their CEOs. I mean, we're going to see some changes here as a result of Obamacare at the end of this year.
Yeah.
But I don't think most people know that.
Nobody knows that, and that's because the so-called liberal media, which you and I call the corporate media, will not tell them that.
Right.
That's up to you.
Well, in part,
me and everybody else.
And it's in part because it's not being hammered out by, it's like, you know, when the Republican, you know, when Bush was in charge, when they wanted to sell that war in Iraq, they took every opportunity every single day. They had a whole network of talking heads out there. They had a, yes, the right wing infrastructure is massively larger and better than the left wing and or the progressive or even the Democratic Party infrastructure. They, you know, it's funded by billionaires who view it as an investment. If they can, you know, if they put money into the right wing politics, Republican politics, it keeps their taxes down and it gets them loopholes and less regulation, blah, 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 so they make more profit. But, yeah, we need to be sharing the word, Ray. We need to be sharing the word. Thank you very much for the call. Michael in Vancouver. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. We sure miss you back out here in Portland, but I'm glad you're still up and bigger than ever. You're welcome. On Troy Davis, listening to the interview with Mike Farrell and you, learning that the Pope has made a comment, I started wondering, does that put it in the realm where the president can weigh in and pardon and at least maybe make a referral to the Supreme Court?
You know, the president conceivably could pardon Troy Davis, but a pardon means you're free, you're out of prison. And if there is... if there's any possibility that this guy actually committed a crime or participated in a crime, that that would be something that would be very, very dangerous politically for a president to do, and perhaps even, you know, from a criminal justice point of view.
What if it was just a hold and then a review?
I don't think he has the ability to do that. The president, the Constitution says the president has the power to issue pardons and letters of marque. That's the language in the Constitution, if my recollection is correct. And it doesn't have any qualifiers or therefores or therebys or, you know, whatever. It would be nice, but I don't think that. And the Supreme Court actually already offered Troy Davis a review, but the conditions that they set up was that he had to prove in that basically review before the parole board or before a lower court, that he had to prove that he was innocent beyond a shadow of a doubt rather than that there was significant doubt about his guilt, which there is. So, Michael, thank you for the call. Ray in Austin, Texas, a minute to the break. Ray, what's up?
Oh, well, you know, I just want to talk about the climate change issue. I think that the Koch brothers and everybody else who is behind this in the energy industry and the conservative talk show hosts that they pay to say to people that climate change is not caused by man, it ain't real, they ought to be penalized. It ought to be against the law, just like yelling fire in a crowded theater is against the law.
Well, I think we just need to call them out like this, the same way that you call out Holocaust deniers, the global warming deniers. They, you know, they're people who are denying basically a crime against nature. I don't think that the speech should be criminalized, but it should be identified as you know, it's like the guys who denied that tobacco caused cancer all those years. Many of them, by the way, are the same people. Many of the people who made a living off the tobacco industry. Thanks, Ray, for the call. Many of the people who made a living off the quote scientists who made a living 20 years ago on the tobacco industry, saying, "Well, we don't have proof that tobacco causes cancer or that tobacco is addictive," are the same people working on the global warming denying business right now. It's amazing. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, Congressman Charlie Rangel crashed Rick Perry's party in Harlem. He'll be here with the details. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I misspoke. Charlie Rangel is going to be with us 1 hour from now. Sorry about that. In any case, let's pick up some of your calls here. Rob in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I've been listening to a lot of talk radio, and I hear a lot of people talking about, I just don't understand the Republicans. And it kind of dawned on me why people can't understand their attitude is because the party is more of a cult than it is a party. And here's my proof. You know, like a cult basically has a spiritual leader and then all of its members. Okay. And then what they try to do in these cults is try to isolate you from the rest of the world. Like, you know, in Jonestown when they went and did all the, you isolate people. So that way you have total mind control over them.
David Koresh.
Well, what's going on right now is we have media control. We have media cults, which is like the Fox News and the, you know, Rush Limbaughs and that, who basically control the message to their cult members. Now, I think the Republican Party is only composed of two types of people, the cult leaders, which is like the top, you know, billionaires, and then the rest of them, which are all the rest of the people underneath that. And then, you know, basically getting the message. And I think they pray to the god of money, or the son of their money, which is dividends. And as we all know, dividends have no conscience. Dividends have no loyalty to country. Dividends have no loyalty to even their own employees.
Yeah. You know, I had a half-hour conversation last night with one of the last living rational Republicans, David Stockman, in our Conversations with Great Minds series. It's up over at, you can see the video at TomHartmann.com. And after the break, I'll put it up at ConversationsWithGreatMinds.com. And David Stockman was basically saying the same thing. In fact, he said that the schism happened in 1983. He told the story about how in 81 they did these massive tax cuts, and it basically drove the economy off the cliff. There was a huge recession in 82, and the debt just started spiraling out of control. And he said within the White House itself, within the Reagan White House, there was this schism, this split into two groups. There was the one group that wanted to raise taxes, and he said Reagan then went on to raise taxes six more times. It was a total of seven. And you know, recoup at least some of, you know, stop the bleeding. And then there was this group of ideologues, the Phil Grahams. You know, he didn't name Phil Graham, but that he was the leader of the ideologues, and he was actually in the Senate at the time. You had these ideologues who just were true believers in this notion that you know, spend as much as you can, tax as little as you can, and everything will turn out just fine, thank you very much. And yeah, we need to bring back the rational Republicans.
You can't have the faith-based economy.
Yeah, no, he called them out. He said, you know, these guys now, I don't remember his exact words, but as I said, you can see it over at TomHartmann.com, but David Stockman basically said these guys now who are running the Republican Party don't get it, and they're running it irrationally. So, Rob, excellent point.
Right.
I would love to see. In fact, I wrote an op-ed back about 5 years ago for Common Dreams titled "Republicans, Please Take Back Your Party." You know, it stands.
Absolutely.
You know, there are still a few. And Lamar Alexander, by the way, did you see he just stepped down from the number three Republican position in the leadership in the United States Senate?
Yeah. And thing that crossed my mind is like he seems like he's outnumbered. He's just like, I can't, you know, do this anymore.
Well, that was my first thought, is or that he had been pushed out, that he had been told, sorry, buddy, because, you know, when John Kyle resigns, John Cornyn in all probability is going to be up for the number two position, and Lamar Alexander would be the competitor for that. And do they really want to have a shootout about that? But Lamar Alexander is saying that he actually he was up in Canada and he thought this thing through and wrote this speech and delivered it yesterday, but it was some time ago that he came to this conclusion that because he was in the leadership of the Republican Party, he could not take a position and work collaboratively with the Democrats because it's simply not allowed because of this cult that you're talking about. And whereas if he resigns from the leadership, then he can be a member of the party, the rank and file of the party. He can be a senator again, and he can actually talk to Democrats and maybe even sign off on legislation, collaborate with them, work with them on things. And the guy's 71 years old. I don't think that this is about his next election campaign. I don't think that it's about politics. I think that he's actually maybe one of the few rational Republicans left.
The thing that scares me about John Kyle is I've been out here for 20 years in Arizona, and I don't know what that guy does. You talk about do nothing.
Yeah,
I don't know what he does. I really don't know what he does.
Yeah, well, he does.
Re-elected, I'm like, I don't know what he does.
He puts a lot of bills on hold, and he does a lot of filibustering, and he does a lot of
absolutely does nothing.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call, Rob. Richard in Fairview. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Yes, I have to ask you a question. It's pertaining to a quote: "Eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth." Do you know if this comes from the Bible or is just some famous person?
I believe the famous person was Jesus. I'd have to go back and look, but my recollection is he said it has been said an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, you know, and he provided an alternative. I may be wrong on that, so it's been a while.
Okay, my question is then, I'm using the term Bible thumbers. That is someone who thumbs through the Bible to pick a quote.
Right.
I do believe in capital punishment. And when the rule says, thou shalt not kill, we go to the next phrase, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Ye who kills will be, what, smitten or whatever you want to say.
Killed.
Terminated.
Yeah. Okay, so you're saying because you believe that if somebody kills somebody, they should be put to death, do you believe that if somebody breaks somebody's arm, their arm should be broken?
No, don't put words in my mouth.
Okay, you said you believe in capital punishment.
I do believe in capital punishment, but I'm calling you on the fact that you quote one part of the Bible and not the other.
Oh, I'm not quoting any part of the Bible.
you did say you didn't.
You asked me where it came from, and I said, I think it came from here, but I'm not sure.
Okay, if thou shalt not kill, and then we turn around and use the other phrase, an eye for an eye, those who commit these crimes should be...
Oh, no, you're talking about my conversation with Mike Farrell. I said thou shalt not kill is not just a religious statement and a statement that all the world's great religions hold, but it is the fundamental human statement. It is the basis of human morality. You find some little tribe in the Amazon that's never had contact with what we call Western civilization. I guarantee you. Probably the number one rule in that society, too, is thou shalt not kill. I mean, this is just a fundamental human thing. We don't kill each other. It has nothing to do with religion. Religion grows out of it, not vice versa.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. Pretty remarkable stuff here. Troy Davis, it looks like all the appeals have been exhausted. Tonight, you and I, well, the good citizens of the state of Georgia directly, this is paid for by the taxpayers of Georgia, but I believe that we're all complicit in this. We have 34 states in the United States that still have the death penalty, are going to put to death a man who almost certainly is innocent. Troy Davis asked for a polygraph before his death. You know, last words, favorite meal? No, I'd like a polygraph. I want to prove I'm innocent. Even if you're going to put me to death, I want to go out having people know that I'm the innocent guy. 10 eyewitnesses testified against him. 8 of them have now said, you know, we were wrong. Several of those 8 have said, the guy who actually did this, he was one of the 10 guys who testified against him. That's one of the 2 people who has not recanted his testimony. Tell me this doesn't stink. There was no DNA. There was no murder weapon ever found. One of the witnesses who went to the police and said Troy Davis did it appears to be the guy who did it himself. He was seen earlier with the gun, like the one that the police officer was shot with. He's running around loose down in Savannah, Georgia, or thereabouts. Today, Troy Davis is going to be executed. And when he said that he was innocent of killing Mark MacPhail, the off-duty police officer who was working as a security guard down in Savannah, and he wants the polygraph test, today, not as some last-minute, you know, stop-the-execution thing, but just, if I have a last wish, this is it. Polygraph me. They said no. Georgia prison officials have said no. It's up to them. They've said no. State legislators down in the state of Georgia. We had, in the last hour, we had Mike Farrell on, who is the founder of the Death Penalty Focus group. Their website is deathpenalty.org, and strongly recommend you get over there and check that out. This is just remarkable. The president spoke this morning at the United Nations. He's doing a bit of a backflip on the Palestine issue. A year ago, he was saying, a year from now, I hope to see a Palestinian state. Now he's saying, not so fast. Palestinians need to work it out with the Israelis. There's some truth to that latter part, and yet at the same time, I think even if this vote is held and even if the U.S. vetoes it, it might put some pressure, frankly, on both parties to negotiate something that will be real. So, Josh Marshall actually wrote a nice piece, an interesting piece about this a little less of a flame piece than Tom Friedman's over the weekend. Josh Marshall over at the Talking Points Memo, TPM, titled Give Me a Break. That the calculus, how complex this calculus has become. The United States is building a massive new prison. Where? In Bagram. We now have more people. We spend more money in the United States. This is a point that Cornel West made over the weekend. I'm accepting his numbers as real. I don't think he would say them if they weren't right. He and I were among the keynote speakers at the Fighting Bob Fest in Madison, Wisconsin this weekend. We spend more money imprisoning African Americans than we do educating them. I mean, that's pretty amazing when you think about it. We're spending the amount of money that we are spending on prison. We have, Reagan National Airport. On my flight out to Madison, come down the escalator, and Louise, is that picture up on our website now? Can people see that at TomHartmann.com? Oh, she's on the phone. I'm sorry. But if it's not up there, we'll get it up there soon. I took a photo with my camera, or with my phone, the camera in my phone. And it said, welcome to the United States, home of 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. An NAACP poster. So anyhow, we now have an RFP, a request for proposals, to build a prison that will cost us between $25 and $100 million. Where in Afghanistan? Yep. Absolutely amazing. Glenn Greenwald writing about this over at Salon.com. You can check this out. Another hostage scenario is brewing, this time in the House of Representatives. The Senate has put a little over $6 billion for disaster relief, the $36 billion worth of damage done by the Joplin tornado, by the hurricanes, by the flooding, by all these natural disasters. We've had everything except plagues of locusts, and they're probably on their way. The fires, the wildfires in the Southwest. Rick Perry's state is on fire. He prays for rain. It doesn't rain for a month and a half. Barack Obama flies into Austin, Texas for just a brief meeting, and the next day it rains. Anyway, this hostage crisis is brewing in as much as the Republicans, the Democratic-controlled Senate. The Democratic-controlled Senate has put almost $7 billion in disaster relief, six and change, into the budget for the next year for the federal government. And the Democrat and the Republicans in the House of Representatives, who control the House of Representatives, Eric Cantor, John Boehner, those guys, they said, nah, only $3 billion and change. Because we can't have programs that actually help people. I mean, if you have programs that actually help people and they actually work, government programs, that gives a lie to the Republican theory, the Republican the thing that Republicans have been running on since Ronald Reagan's presidency, that government should be shrunk down to the size of a bathtub, or down to the size where it can be drained, not killed altogether, but just drained out of the drain of the bathtub, to paraphrase Grover Norquist. Because it's incompetent and can't do things. This is why they hate Social Security, because Social Security has never failed to write a check. So anyhow, keep an eye on this. This $3.6 billion out of the House, nearly $7 billion out of the Senate for disaster relief. The other thing, the other reason why the Republicans don't want this money spent on disaster relief in this coming fiscal year to 2012 is because if that money is spent on disaster relief, that means putting people to work, rebuilding bridges and roads that got washed out, and telephone poles that got knocked over, and on and on and on, right, from the hurricanes to the floods to everything else. And if you put people to work doing those things, you lower the unemployment rate. In fact, Mitch McConnell wrote a letter. The Senate Republicans have sent a letter to Ben Bernanke saying, please don't, please don't do anything to fix the economy. When the Fed was created in 1913, it has two mandates, and they are equal, 50-50. Control inflation maintain a low level of unemployment. In other words, make sure that people have jobs, make sure we don't have inflation. We don't have inflation. So the Fed should be doing something about employment. And the Republicans are saying, please don't do anything about employment. You do something about employment, you know what's going to happen? President Obama will win the next election. We've got to run against a bad economy, so we need a bad economy. So please, Ben Bernanke, give us a bad economy. Don't do anything. Time will tell. Did you see, though, where the International Monetary Fund, this was in the Financial Times yesterday, it was one of the things I was going to rant about yesterday and never got around to. There's so much stuff going on. The IMF has come out and warned us, the United States, among other countries, against austerity programs like the Republicans are preaching. In other words, don't cut any more spending programs because you are going to create a depression if you do. The IMF.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, an eye for an eye, we will talk about that. Actually, several comments on that. Troy Davis, comments on Palestine, question about the Obama comment. We'll be back with your calls and thoughts as well.
People are talking about people.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 20 minutes past the hour. The Talk Media for the Rest of Us program. And in the past hour, in the last hour, just as we were coming out of the, just as we were wrapping up the last hour, we had a caller call me up and, you know, I am opposed to the death penalty. We had in the last hour as a guest Mike Farrell, the actor and author, who is also the leader of an organization called Death Penalty Focus. Their website is deathpenalty.org. And we were talking about, you know, thou shalt not kill, and an eye for an eye is kind of outdated and outmoded. And somebody called and said that they were in favor of the death penalty. And, you know, it was not quite a coherent message, I guess. You know, he said, where in the Bible does it say eye for an eye? I'm not sure. I think maybe Jesus said it. That, you know, it is said an eye for an eye, but I say, or something like that. But I don't frankly remember. And then he went off on this thing about that. And Marsha apparently has a response or a correction or a comment on that. Marsha in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Marsha.
Hi, Tom. The eye for an eye, first of all, is a mistranslation. It occurs in Exodus 21, verse 24.
Okay.
That's where Jesus got it.
Uh-huh. Did Jesus quote that?
Probably.
Yeah.
I'm more familiar with Torah and Tanakh than I am with New Testament.
Okay.
However, the word, it does not say an eye for an eye. It says an eye, tachat, an eye, and repeats that word. Tachat means under. This is a toting up. They're talking about compensation. The value of an eye for an eye.
Oh,
the value of a tooth for a tooth.
Uh-huh. So you pay, in other words, victim reimbursement or recompensation.
Well, it's compensation, yeah.
Compensation.
It has nothing to do with, I mean, the translation has been wrong for all these centuries.
Right. Fascinating. Marsha, thank you for sharing that with us.
Also, you're welcome.
So, yes.
Also, Hannah is right about the translation not being thou shalt not kill, but being thou shalt not murder.
Yeah, I believe.
That's another, you know, if you look, that happens to be in Exodus 20 somewhere.
Right, yeah. That's
it's part of the Ten Commandments. And they come up a couple of times.
Right, in Leviticus as well.
They come
Deuteronomy.
Up Deuteronomy again.
Yep.
But seriously, the eye for an eye is a major mistranslation.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that, Marsha. I appreciate the information. Jim in Washington State. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, I'm talking about eye for an eye, too, and my understanding was when I was in school, they talked about that was a better situation than if somebody cast out your eye and you killed them. The Jews said, no, that's not the right thing. You can take somebody else's eye out. So, and it's what this lady just finished saying was it's a matter of what's just compensation.
Yeah.
But Jesus had, I think, a very, very different approach to life. And, you know, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And I don't see where murder fits into that.
Right. And forgive and forgive. And who among you without sin, you know, cast the first stone. And
right, yeah. right. And thou shalt love thy Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul and all thy mind. And thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself on these two commandments, saying all the law and the prophets. And I don't believe, and, you know, the Catholic Church goes along with this. They're not in favor of capital punishment, and
right.
I consider them kind of a conservative organization.
Yeah.
So,
well, and the capital, and to their credit, the Catholic Church has been absolutely consistent on this for a long, 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 long time. Thank you, Jim. Good point. Tim in Seattle. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm a first-time caller, and
thank
I'm
you.
Calling because of this Troy Davis situation.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that our leaders should lead, and since Obama is our main leader, the president, I think he should speak up on this. Richard Nixon had no problem coming out during the Charlie Manson trial and saying he was guilty. Do you remember that?
I do. It was. I don't remember it as in I remember the moment it happened. But I remember a controversy about it. He said that though. Wasn't that like in answer to a question or parenthetically?
I'm not sure.
But it did kind of screw up the trial because. Because he said it on national television. That's my recollection.
Yeah.
But at this point,
I think that Obama ought to weigh in on this. And actually, the real reason they aren't going to let this guy off the hook is because they don't want any innocent person to come out of a situation like that and get an attorney and go back into the system and prosecute the people that persecuted him.
Well, I think it's that they want him dead and out of the way so that nobody will pay attention to it. I mean, it's, you know, this is what is plaguing Rick Perry. And Tim, thank you for the call. This is what is plaguing Rick Perry right now, is that he executed a guy who almost certainly was innocent. This man had three children in his home. His home caught on fire. He fled the house. He tried to get back into the house to get to his kids. He had burns all over his body as a consequence of that. He couldn't get his kids out. They died. He was a grieving father. And then he was charged with having intentionally set the fire. And after he was executed, one of these groups that's like, you know, looking into the guilt of people found that there was no evidence that the fire had been set. It was an accidental fire. And the guy really was a grieving father. And the panel that was evaluating this, the official state panel was evaluating this in the state of Texas, it was clearly going to come to this conclusion and say so publicly that Rick Perry had killed an innocent man. And so Rick Perry had the head of the panel fired. He fired him and replaced him with one of his cronies. And the panel has never issued its public conclusions now. They've just buried them. They deep sixed the whole thing. And that's, you know, that's what's going on in Georgia, in my opinion, right now, is that the you know, if they admit one mistake, one of the things that we know from the Innocent Project is that when they start looking into death penalty cases, particularly death penalty cases where an African American is the one who's getting the death penalty, and the had a public defender, that about 1 in 10 were actually innocent people. And, you know, down in Georgia, they don't want to talk about it. It's like they're in denial. It's like a family of an alcoholic or something. We don't want to talk about it. And, you know, let's just get it over with and done with. That's what's going on down in Georgia. It's wrong. Absolutely wrong.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we're expanding our secret war across the Middle East and North Africa. I'll tell you about that after the break and take more on your calls. And Charlie Rangel's going to drop by. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And, oh, that's interesting. Flo in Sunrise, Florida, pardoning Troy Davis is a disaster?
Well, no, Tom, don't get me wrong, because we went on to NAACP.org and signed it.
Uh-huh.
I said it would be a disaster for Obama.
Oh, if he did that. Yeah, yeah.
Like you said, you know, he would be out of prison. From what I hear, I don't know if he's guilty or not, but the guy wanted to take one of those...
A polygraph test.
polygraph test.
Yeah.
So that
lie detector test.
Yeah, but if Obama ever did that, you know, the Republicans would have a field day with it.
Oh,
let a cop killer off the hook.
Yep. Yeah.
Don't you think?
I absolutely do, and that's and plus, if there is even any possibility that Troy Davis is guilty, even though it overwhelmingly looks like he's not, if there's even any possibility, then I don't think that the president would be well advised to issue a pardon. I just, you know, I do, you know, agree that his speaking out on the message would not be a bad thing. Although, again, that it would become political fodder and, you know, the Republicans would use it. But, you know, Flo, very good point. Thank you very much for the question or for the call. Van in Portland. Hey, Van, what's up?
Hey, sorry I have an off-topic question, but I was hoping you could provide some clarity. Obama made a comment about wiping off some of the bad foreclosure debt off the books for the banks. My question is, couldn't he also, if he did that, couldn't he also stimulate the economy by giving some type of credit forgiveness to the people that actually had the foreclosures?
Yes, and in fact, that's largely how Franklin Roosevelt did it. You know, he let the banks fail. You know, just screw the banks. They got screwed. At that time, there was no FDIC, so unfortunately, the depositors got screwed as well. But then he created a federal agency that took over people's mortgages. Typically, back then in the 1920s, 1930s, mortgages were only 5 years, and they were balloon payments at the end, with the assumption that you would either sell the property or you'd roll over the mortgage. And it pretty much invented this whole concept of a 30-year mortgage, and they were federally funded, and it worked. In fact, it made a profit. So it was a very, very successful program. Very successful program. Candu in New York. Hey, Candu, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You got to help me, man, answer a question for me. I've been looking at this political thing with the Republicans and stuff like that, and I'm starting to feel like I'm watching, like, Rosemary's Baby. You ever seen Rosemary's Baby?
Yeah, I never saw the movie, but I know what the storyline was, yeah.
Well, basically, Rosemary has
the spawn of Satan, basically.
Satan, yeah, basically. Yeah. And it just so happens that her and her husband move into a building where everybody's like falling all over for this child. But she's the only one that sees that it's a devil.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, I think it was last week or so you had brought out the fact that the star, the RNC, is basically turned upside down, the 5-point star. And I'm like,
yeah.
Whoa. You know, and then I'm looking at how they're basically holding this country hostage with the debt and disaster relief and stuff like that. And I'm like, wow, and they still act like they have some kind of contention in winning the presidential seat. And I'm like, wow, does anybody else see what I'm seeing?
Well, that's the thing. For example, they're flipping the 5-pointed star upside down has not been reported in any media. It's just, you know, occasionally. In fact, even some of the networks, even MSNBC occasionally, will take the Republican logo and they'll turn the 5-pointed star right side up. Even though when you look at the GOP's website, the star is upside down. I mean, that's the official GOP logo, is that to have the 5-pointed star upside down. Nobody wants to talk about it. It sounds like a crackpot theory. Why would they turn the stars upside down? You know, but I guarantee you, if the Democratic Party had done that, the Republicans, you would be getting, you know, there would be this viral email going around about how Obama was a secret Satanist and that's why he did it. Right? I guarantee
that's already
you.
Going around.
Right. And he hasn't even flipped the star upside down.
Rosemary's Baby or watch it, child. You'll see what I mean.
Yeah, okay. Can do. Thank you very much. I'm not sure I want to because I think I'm watching it in real time right now. I think you're right in the Republican Party. Cece in Colorado. Hey, Cece, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You had mentioned earlier something about all the disaster that we've had, floods, et cetera,
yeah,
and how the GOP are reluctant to give us money for that. And then you mentioned something about, the plague. Well, Tom, we really have had a plague. We've had a plague of GOP, of the corporate wealthy, of the parasitic wealthy. We've had a plague of them for a really long time.
Mm.
And as far as government programs, and there's so much, the GOP is so opposed to government programs, we have had one of the largest government programs that has been the most profitable for a few, called war.
Yes.
And now they're building a prison. And they can disappear Americans to that prison.
Yeah. They can't actually under the current policies. And yeah, I was referring to the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, and and I said seems like the only one we haven't seen so far is plague. Although famine is one of them, but we have malnourished children in America, and Republicans want to cut programs for them too. And yeah, I think that, you know, back in the day when Paul had his vision on the island of Skarnos or something like that, in any case, when he was exiled to that island and he had the vision that he wrote down as the Book of Revelation, that at that time the corporate form didn't exist, or he would have had five horsemen of the apocalypse. I'm with you, Cece. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. Barb in Indiana. Hey, Barb, what's up?
Hey, I'm going to use you like a library instead of going over there. I occasionally give bits of money to the Democratic Party, and I was called about a week ago by a fundraiser, and he wasn't just hired. He actually was an activist. And I said something that I was disappointed with our poor President Obama that he hadn't really waded into the job situation. I live in a rural area, and it's terrific unemployment. That he really hadn't waded into this job stuff like Roosevelt did. And the young man said, you have to remember that FDR wasn't able to start these programs until his second term.
That's not
the
true.
Implication being, of course, I know FDR served more than two terms, but
right.
Nevertheless, the implication being that once President Obama is no longer faced with the stresses of having to be reelected, and in essence can't be reelected, he will be more free to exercise stronger leadership.
Yeah. There may be some truth to the conclusion. I mean, it's entirely possible that as a lame duck president, President Obama will actually have more power and more freedom to do the right thing and the things that he thinks are right. That conclusion might be right. But the reality is that in my opinion, the very best book on this is actually not a biography of Franklin Roosevelt. It's a biography of Frances Perkins, who was the first female Secretary of Labor in the history of the United States. FDR made her Secretary of Labor, when he was inaugurated in March of 1932, and she put together the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and the WPA, and they had hired, by the second week of his presidency, they had hired 10,000, they had 10,000 people working in the CCC.
Okay.
So, he hit the ground running. And he had 3 months to plan for that, by the way, because back then the elections were in November, 4 months. The elections were in November and the presidents were sworn in March. And so for 4 months we had to suffer under Herbert Hoover doing absolutely nothing and being a lame duck president and doing nothing. And the Depression just got worse and worse and worse. And during that time, Roosevelt and Frances Perkins, who was very good friends with his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, and others, there was this kind of cabal of progressives inside the White House, put together the New Deal, basically, and made this thing happen. And that's, by the way, that four-month wait that happened in 1932, that horrible four-month wait when people were dying and freezing and literally, freezing to death because they couldn't afford to heat their homes and things like that. That four-month wait is the reason why the Constitution was amended to have the president be sworn in January instead of in March.
Wow.
Yeah, because everybody saw how horrible it was to have to wait 4 months for Franklin Roosevelt to take the reins of power from Herbert Hoover, from the Republicans. And so that's why the swearing in, and not just the president, Congress and everybody else, it all got moved up. It used to be 4 months on the, on the theory that it takes that long for somebody to ride on horseback from Florida all the way up to Washington, D.C. and figure things out. But, when the horse and buggy went away, it was no longer necessary. So the young person you spoke with, I doubt that he or she was lying to you, but was wrong. Just didn't know the facts. So thank you, Barb, for the call. And by the way, this biography of Frances Perkins, I read this about 2 years ago, I think, and made it one of my BuzzFlash books of the month. If you go to BuzzFlash.com, you can read the book review I wrote of it. And I review a book or a movie or something for them every month, more or less, as to help them raise money for their website. And it was, I've read a lot of histories of the New Deal and of FDR and whatnot, and there's some brilliant ones out there, some very, long, comprehensive, thoughtful ones, and really, really well done. But watching, having the story of the New Deal told through the through the eyes of or through the story of the first female Secretary of Labor and everything that she dealt with in that, a woman who in almost certainly was lesbian as well, and she dealt with that, and there was that whole underground, and a woman who was a dedicated progressive, and this whole progressive group in New York and Washington, D.C. that came together to help make the New Deal happen. It's just a brilliant, brilliant book. I'm quite sure the title is The Woman Behind the New Deal. And, yeah, and Jacob just confirmed that to me. And it's the biography of Frances Perkins. It's really worth reading. I couldn't put it down. I literally was staying up till 2 o'clock in the morning reading this book. Barb, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Well, and Lord willing, and the phones still work, Charlie Rangel will be with us after the break. 45 minutes. He had a little visit with Rick Perry yesterday. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. The Harvard Program and Congressman Charlie Rangel on the line with us. Charles Rangel, the congressman from the 15th District of New York, rangel.house.gov, his website. Congressman, welcome back. Congressman?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey.
I'm so sorry, Tom.
That's quite all right.
Okay, I'm with you.
Okay, we are on the air. I understand that Rick Perry came into your neighborhood the other day. Was it yesterday, the day before?
Not that I know of. As a matter of fact, I had not known that he was coming, except I heard on the radio, and I was in the neighborhood, so I thought I'd stop by. I had no idea it was a fundraiser, but I thought I'd take this opportunity to show that no matter what one's political ideology is, that they would be welcome to my congressional district.
Yeah, I think
of course side thoughts was the more they see and hear Rick, the more support Obama will be getting out of my district.
I suspect you're right. Now, meanwhile, there's serious business going on. You've got this House Resolution 2394, Rebuilding America's School Act, that you're sponsoring?
Yes, indeed.
Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, it's a part, really, of the president's commitment to make certain that this fiscal setback does not interfere with the moving forward that we have to do in school building, mm-hmm. and that it fits right into the jobs program. But, you know, people talk about no spending and no revenues, but just saying that you're cutting spending doesn't mean you're saving money. We still have to educate our children. We still have to have bridges and tunnels and infrastructure. So this is a part that I have been my main interest, besides peace and not these unwarranted, unconstitutional war, have been the education of our kids. It's been a key for me from the streets of Lenox Avenue and from people from rural and inner city areas. You need to have an education. And
yeah.
So therefore, when I saw the president with this bill, I pulled out my bill and said, hey, let's rebuild our schools and have an atmosphere which is conducive to kids learning math and science and allowing our great country to once again become competitive.
Now, we have, as the consequence of these wild, wild storms that seem to be associated with the 5% more atmospheric moisture we have now than we did 30 years ago because of global warming, we've generated
global
30...
Global warming?
Yeah.
You obviously did not listen to the Republican presidential debate.
I did. But in any case, these storms have generated $36 billion worth of damage. The Democrats in the Senate have said, okay, let's answer the call of the governors in the various states who have declared emergencies and are asking for help and give them six and change, almost $7 billion in relief. In the House of Representatives, though, Eric Cantor, John Boehner, the Republicans are saying, no, only three and change, $3 billion. And we're going to put it this major budget bill, this omnibus bill. So if the Democrats insist on more, it's going to grind government to a halt. How, if the Republicans in Congress and the House of Representatives are so committed to not putting people back to work, rebuilding places like Joplin, Missouri, that have been devastated by a tornado, how do you think that you can get an education bill through where they would, you know, rebuild the schools that have been devastated by 30 years of Reaganomics and neglect?
I think the president recognized that there's nothing constructive that he can do, that the Republicans intend to meet him halfway. And so therefore what he has done, and we have tried to do, is to take this to the street, take it to the American people, indeed take it to the small business people, take it to the people that need a strong America to continue to make more money. And I'm certain that if you ask any school teacher, if the teachers and the principals and even the kids would call up their congressperson and say, hey, I want to learn, but I need a new place I need a place that's conducive to learning.
Right.
And in addition to that, you know, you can't do it with a building, and the president's trying to avoid the layoff of teachers. And so in answer to your question, the future of our country is more important to leave it just in the hands of the federal government. We need the guidance and support of educators, spiritual and moral leaders to push their member of Congress, and I can honestly say, just tell them to do the right thing.
Right, and that would be to call your member of Congress and say, sign on to H.R. 2394.
You bet your life. That's the way to get it done.
The Rebuilding America School Act. Sir, while we have you with us, we just have a minute or two, and I know you're on the run too, but last time we talked about how a draft might have something to, you know, might very quickly end our wars. Any progress on that?
No, but I have made talks on that, and now I really have a concerted effort to try to get the religious leaders involved in this draft thing. You know, the saving of life, humanity has a deep moral commitment to try to save lives, notwithstanding the fact that some people in the Tea Party are just overjoyed when a hypothetical 30-year-old kid died with no insurance.
Right.
But our spiritual leaders, human life is the creation of God. And so when you find over 6,000 American violent men and women dying for this country in a war that has no constitutional authority, you would think that every religion would say, stop the killing on both sides. But we don't hear from them. And so I don't expect that the Congress is going to say, hey, I don't mind my grandkids and my kids being placed in harm's way for the good of the country. I support the draft. I don't expect that. But I do expect that they will acknowledge that they are somebody's kids, grandkids, that are dying. And perhaps then, well, I know, we would be more reluctant to put our country in harm's way, our kids in harm's way, if we thought for 1 minute that it could affect our families and sometimes our communities.
Yeah, and I think as a decorated war veteran, your words have so much more weight than chicken hawks like Dick Cheney. Congressman Charles Rangel, Charlie Rangel, thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Always a pleasure, and thank you for all the good work you do, Tom.
Thank you very much. And people can get more information about H.R. 2394 over at rangel.house.gov. We'll be back. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And one of the interesting issues that has come out of the Republican debates, and, you know, frankly, well, I don't know, you know, whether this is going to be an issue on the Democratic side or not. This whole issue where Rick Perry was attacked by Michelle Bachmann in, I believe it was the last debate, for issuing an executive order, which was later, by the way, overturned by the Texas legislature, so it never actually became policy or law or whatever it would be called in Texas. That in order for a 12-year-old girl to enroll in school, which presumably is moving from elementary school into middle school or whatever, they have to show a certificate of vaccination for the HPV virus, the human papillomavirus, which is a variation of a wart virus that causes a variety of conditions, including cervical cancer, principally cervical cancer. among others, and in fact has been implicated in prostate cancer. It's been implicated in cancers of the throat, particularly cancer of the tonsils, and is sexually transmitted. And the vaccine only works if you get it before you're exposed to the virus. And the pushback on the right has been, if you vaccinate a child against a sexually transmitted disease, then they may believe that they can have sex without ever getting diseases, and it's like giving them a license to have disease. Or there's the much smaller crowd who are just hysterical about vaccines in general, and mandating vaccines is, and then there's another subset that says, you know, how dare the government mandate anything? The kind of Ron Paul crowd, if somebody's going to be vaccinated, their parents should do it themselves in their basement with a nail and, you know, pour the vaccine on. I don't, something like that. Heather Sermo is with us. She is a conservative PR strategist and associate with Blueskin Solutions. BlueskinSolutions.com is the website. Her Twitter is hsermo, it's C-I-R-M-O. And Heather, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great. You're welcome. Thank you for joining us on this. This is, first of all, every state, current law allows minors between the ages of 12 and 17 to consent to receive STD, sexually transmitted diseases, diagnosis, and treatments in pretty much every state for the last 50 years. Why not consent to at least allow them to say, yes, I'll take the vaccine, even without discussing it with their parents?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that HPV is now seen as the sole cause of cervical cancer. And, that's no small thing. So parents definitely need to know that information. And so to get this vaccine is not just to protect you against a sexually transmitted disease. It's also protecting your daughter against contracting cervical cancer down the road. And that's regardless of whether your child is you're encouraging your child to remain a virgin, or if you're saying, get into the right relationship. It doesn't matter what kind of message you're sending to your child. Cervical cancer can afflict anybody, even if you marry as a virgin.
Because your husband may not be a virgin.
Yeah, exactly. And HPV is also a very pernicious STD in that you don't have to have full-fledged intercourse to contract it. You can just, have heavy petting or something like that to actually get it. So there needs to be education given to parents about how this disease is different from a lot of other STDs. Now, as far as whether California should approve this controversial measure that would mandate that 12-year-old girls, sixth-grade girls, get this vaccine without their parents' consent, that's a different story. And California especially is going through a major budget problem.
Aren't we talking about Texas here, or is there a?
Well, I'm sorry. There was an HPV controversy that's been brought up, but in California, I meant to mention this. California, right now, pending on Jerry Brown's desk, is legislation that would enable girls to get the HPV vaccine at age 12 without their parents' consent. It's already been approved by the legislature. And granted, California has already undermined parental rights a great deal. So this is kind of consistent with their policy.
Well, here's
but from a tax point of view, this doesn't seem to be the right time for California to do something like this.
Yeah. First of all, it seems to me odd that we wouldn't be giving 12-year-old boys this vaccine as well, since they're transmitting this thing.
Well, if it were effective in boys, then perhaps we would be having that discussion. But right now, it is not.
I see. Okay. Thank you for educating me about that.
I'm sure that Merck and other pharmaceutical giants are researching right now.
Double the market, right.
To your pleasure.
But here's my concern. Back in 1978, Louise and I started a community for abused kids in New Hampshire, the New England Salem Children's Village. It's still there. It's been running for 30-plus years and doing marvelous work, and has saved a lot of kids' lives. And I remember the first kid that we did intake on was the daughter of her father of her sister by her father. The second kid and had tried to kill a couple of foster parents, and her father was still out there. The second kid that we did intake on was a kid who had been tied in the basement along with his brother as a punishment, and his brother had died of starvation in the basement. And the neighbors noticed the smell, and that's how they found Tony. and that's how he ended up in our facility. Louise was the program director there, and she dealt with the parents. I was the executive director. I did fundraising and administrative stuff, but she dealt with these parents for 5 years. And I can tell you, the world is full of parents who will not do the right thing by their kids. There's a lot who just don't have the time or don't have the ability or don't have the education, and then there are those who are even malicious. And shouldn't a 12-year-old, regardless of their life situation, have the ability to walk into a doctor's office and say, please protect me from cervical cancer. My parents aren't going to do it for me.
Well, I mean, that's a good point. I think that that is the I want to be a thoughtful conservative. You know, I don't want to just say, oh, that's liberal legislation, it's not worth considering, because I know that these legislative ideas are birthed with good intentions. And I do think that that is what this legislation is for. It's not for, you know, the 12-year-old who comes from a middle-class family that goes to church every Sunday and eats dinner together every night. This is for those children who are just talking about in crisis. And it, when it trickles down to the people out here on the East Coast, we think, oh, my gosh, it's trampling. They're trampling on parental rights, when the reality is California has already had these kind of measures in place for years, and this would actually just be adding to legislation that's already been there with regard to STDs. So the reality is we need to help those kids who do not come from good families that care about giving them the medical treatment that they need, or perhaps can't even afford it. I also want to take that in consideration. But there also needs to be education on the part of parents, and we need to make sure that parents understand that this vaccine is helpful, and it should be, I think, it should be given to all girls, you know, whether it's paid for by the parents, which I think is the best way to do it, they can afford it, or by the state if that's necessary, because cervical cancer can be something that we are rid of.
It kills a lot of women.
It kills a lot of women. It kills 4,000 women a year. 11,000 women are diagnosed with it every year. By God's grace, you know, with medical help, we are able to diagnose it early and treat it early, and that is the secret to success when it comes to cervical cancer. So finding out if a girl has HPV is one thing, but helping her not ever get it is quite another.
But am I hearing one of my favorite conservative debate partners here's call for big government programs for education and paying for vaccines?
Well, we already have things in place. We already have the CDC in place to help educate people on the nature of all kinds.
Should we be teaching this in the schools?
No, I don't think we should be teaching this in the schools. I don't think that sex education is...
So you don't think a 12-year-old should be informed what the consequences of that heavy petting could be if they don't have the vaccine?
No, I do. I think all the consequences should be laid out, and the best course of action should be recommended to a child, as long as we have sex education in the classroom, which I think it's here to stay.
Yeah.
Ideally, we wouldn't have it. It wouldn't be the place for school to do that. We would have other means.
Heather, we're out of time, but we got it. Thank you.
All right, Tom.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I hate it when that voice comes up and steps on me or my guests. It's Life in the Big City. We'll be right back with more of your thoughts on this. 15 minutes past the hour. Okay, we were just talking with Heather a few minutes ago about the HPV vaccine and the virus, and I ended it by saying, well, shouldn't we be teaching kids about the dangers of this virus? You know, before they're old enough to be exposed to it, to be sexually active, and at that point it was like, oh, no, we shouldn't be teaching sex ed in the schools. Let's continue that conversation. Carol Swain is with us. Carol is a conservative commentator, a law professor at Vanderbilt University, the author of numerous books. Her latest, Be the People, A Call to Reclaim America's Faith and Promise. Her website, Carol Swain, Carol M. Swain. Do I have that right, Carol.com?
Yes.
CarolMSwain.com. And Twitter, Carol M. Swain, S-W-A-I-N. Carol is C-A-R-O-L. Carol, welcome back to the program.
Hello.
Boy, there's a funny echo in there someplace. I don't know if that's something that Jacob can take out. Tell me, in Texas, they have this abstinence-only curriculum, and the result has been that they rank 5th in the nation in teen pregnancy, 4th in the rate in the nation in rates of syphilis among teens, and 3rd in the nation in terms of young people infected with HIV. Isn't it time to do away with the abstinence-only sex education and actually start teaching kids about what happens if you have sex beyond just, you know, scary stuff?
I was not aware that Texas had abstinence-only education. I don't know how it's being taught, if it's being taught by, you know.
96% of the school districts have abstinence-only education in the state of Texas.
My position is I'm in favor of abstinence being taught along with regular sex education, because abstinence is the only form of sex prevention that's 100% protection against pregnancy when it's applied. But it's not for every person. And I think that parents that want to teach their children that and have it reinforced in the schools, and there may be some young people that have never heard of that as an option, it would be good to expose them to that. But surely they do need education about sexually transmitted diseases, about incest, about all the dangers that young people face.
Mm-hmm. Pregnancy?
I'm thinking about from teachers and child molesters and troop leaders and all of these other
pregnancy for a 13, 14, 15-year-old, pregnancy is a very serious medical condition.
Yes, and do you know something, too, that when we sexualize our children too young and give them information that they're not necessarily ready for, by leading them to feel that they can experiment with sex, and if they use sex education, they'll be fine. Teenagers have a high failure rate when it comes to use of condoms and birth control. And so it would be better if we had an educational system that tried to discourage them from experimenting.
Well, I don't think anybody, Carol, any rational person would argue that sex education should not include a strong argument that, you know, wait as long as you can and to have sex, and perhaps even until the day that you're married, if that's your particular moral or religious belief. But that said, I would like to push back on your assertion that teaching children about the biological mechanics of sex, something that is, you know, pretty much all of us at some point in our life.
Have you ever seen Roe v. Harris's It's Perfectly Normal and some of the curriculum that Planned Parenthood has fostered on children as young as 8 and 9? I think they're not ready at that age for all the information that's being given out.
You don't think they're getting it from their friends?
Pardon?
You don't think they're getting it from their friends anyway?
I think they're ready for a sex education that's appropriate for their age, and I'm not going to defend any educational system that's not providing young people and children with sex education that includes information about incest, as well as sexually transmitted disease. Those things young people need, because they are getting it from everywhere.
Okay, so you're in favor of sex education for young children.
I'm sorry, yes,
but you're not
in
favor of
it. As long as it includes abstinence, because that's the only protection that's 100% effective against pregnancy. And so I would like to see it included and taught along with a program of sexual education that someone like me, a reasonable person, would approve.
Okay, and so
I'm saying,
you know,
that maybe Texas
here's my curiosity.
Revisit the issue.
Yeah, I don't think that I'm unusual in this. I probably became aware of sex at around 7, 8 years old. I think that's probably when kids, at least boys, start noticing that something's going on, see a friend's dad's Playboy magazine or, you know, that kind of thing. And today, kids can go on the Internet and very easily find pictures of people having just plain old flat-out intercourse at any age, easily.
I mean, I think it's awful, and I think BET and a lot of the television, MTV, that young people watch, that it really sexualizes them at a level that they're not ready for, and it may be more harmful to young women and girls than to boys.
You know, I'm not disagreeing with you at all on that and the role of the media in that, but what I'm saying is don't we have even a greater obligation now when this kind of frankly non-normal sexual behavior is available to kids on the Internet, to at least explain to them what normal sexual behavior is, even long before they're going to be doing it?
I'm sorry, I'm not disagreeing with you.
I'm talking about 8 and 9 year olds.
No, but I'm saying that it would have to be age appropriate. I would have someone that's reasonable would have to see it and approve it, because I know that Robie Harris's book, it's perfectly normal. It's like a book of pornography. It even has young people engaged in sexual positions, and it's teaching them how to. And I would encourage you to take a look at that book and tell me if you approve of it
for your children.
Would you approve of Robie Harris's It's Perfectly Normal? And I'm sure I'm selling copies of her book as I speak.
I suspect you are. Okay, Carol Swain, carolswain.com. Thank you, Carol, for dropping by.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. Interesting topic. We'll be back 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming up next, your calls and thoughts on the news of the day and the good, the bad, and the incredibly ugly. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very NAPA formally ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, Congressman Phil Rowe. While I may disagree with the Republican from Tennessee on practically everything, he did save a man's life yesterday, and that deserves recognition. While walking through the Charlotte airport, Rowe heard someone calling for a doctor, and he saw a man lying on the ground not breathing. Rowe used to be an obstetrician. A doctor, and immediately sprung into action to give the man CPR until paramedics showed up and got the man's heart beating again. Now only if we can get Roe to show the same sort of compassion when he takes votes in Congress. The bad, South Carolina Republicans. Even though President Obama released his birth certificate back in April, birtherism is still alive and well in the Palmetto State. According to a new Winthrop poll, 36% of South Carolina Republicans still think the president was probably or certainly born outside the United States. 30% think he's a Muslim, and 75% think he's a socialist. Like a cockroach, birtherism is resilient in South Carolina and likely won't go away anytime soon, at least as long as Fox so-called news is still on the airwaves. And the very, very ugly, Rick, don't Google my name, Santorum. In an interview yesterday with Politico, Santorum went after Google, accusing the internet giant of having an agenda against him and negatively impacting the country. It all comes down to the frothy search results that come up when you Google Rick Santorum's name. You can check it out for yourself, but I wouldn't advise that. Santorum said, I suspect if something was up there like that about Joe Biden, they'd get rid of it. If you're a responsible business, you don't let things like that happen in your business that have an impact on the country. No, Rick, your Google search results really have no impact on the country whatsoever, though they could have an impact on your presidential campaign. Perhaps that's something you should have thought about before you decided to base your entire political career on homophobia. That's very, very ugly. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So we're building a new prison in Bagram. In Afghanistan, we've got a bid out, $100 million. You want to make $100 million? Hey, we want to build a prison. Our prisons here are falling apart. We got way too many people in them. 25% of the world's prisoners in this country, 5% of the world's population. Tell me that makes any sense. Troy Davis sitting on death row right now. Looks like he's going to be executed 7 o'clock tonight by the state of Georgia. Hopefully, the horror of this case will not go away with his death, but will be transformed into something positive, into a change in those 34 states where this barbaric practice is still conducted. Mike Farrell's website, or his organization's website, Death Penalty Focus, is deathpenalty.org. And get over there and check out what you can do. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Another hostage scenario brewing. The Republicans in the House of Representatives want to make sure that people in hurricane, storm, flood, or tornado-ravaged areas do not get disaster relief, because that would put people back to work fixing things damaged, and it would help the economy, and it would lower unemployment. So while the Democrats in the Senate are offering six and change, almost $7 billion to repair some of the $36 billion worth of damage that we've seen from these natural disasters. The House Republicans are saying no more than three, or three and change, 3 point, what, 3.3, 3 point something. So it's pretty scary. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Kathy in Rhode Island. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Yes, I wanted to talk about the HPV virus.
Yes.
I consider myself progressive, but every once in a while I have a libertarian streak. Nobody seems to be talking about the difference between things that are contagious, airborne contagious, and communicable. And I think that there's a distinction in what the state should do in terms of something that is a public risk to anybody in the who comes in contact with them versus something that would be communicable through sex. Could you comment on that, please?
Yeah. I think that if we have 4,000 women a year dying of cervical cancer and we could end it, even if it's not through the air contagious, that we should do so. I think that the notion, the idea that there is anybody out there who has ever in their whole entire life only had sex with one person, I mean, certainly there are, and there's probably a fair minority of people who fall into that category, but it's a minority. And as Heather pointed out, this communicating this disease doesn't even require. It can be transmitted with a kiss.
I didn't realize it could be.
Yeah, and this is it doesn't require intercourse, and it doesn't. I mean, this is. Well, maybe I'm wrong. My understanding is that HPV can be transmitted, you know, wherever it happens to be in the body, and that it's implicated in some cancers that have to do with the mouth and the throat. Perhaps I'm. I am not an expert on this. Let me just stop myself right here. I still think, even if it's only communicated by sex, by petting or by sexual intercourse, I think that enough people participate in that if we can knock this thing out, it would be a good thing. Now, in the meantime, yeah. I realize that there are people who are opposed to vaccines.
Responsibility.
Say that again?
Is that the state's responsibility?
It becomes a question of, you know, if 4,000 people are dying every year, 4,000 women are dying every year of a disease that is caused exclusively by this virus, and we can knock out this virus, make it go away, we can prevent everybody from having that, and eliminate the need for an entire industry of annual pap smears and all this other kind of stuff, it seems to me like a good thing.
I agree it's a good thing, but I don't know whether it should be dictated by the state.
Yeah, well, okay. That's the debate that's being had, Kathy, and California, they're not even dictating it by the state. The legislation on Jerry Brown's desk is to allow a 12-year-old to go to a doctor and ask for the vaccine without their parents' consent.
Right.
And that to me is a no-brainer. And that 12-year-olds should also get, they should be sufficiently well educated by the state to know that A, this vaccine is available, and B, that there are dangers associated with vaccines. That all should be part of the education, in my opinion. Kathy, thank you for the call. This is one of those interesting things where there are some fairly clear lines, but not entirely bright lines. Brent in Oregon. Hey, Brent.
Oh, Tom, thank you so much for taking my call. I guarantee you the information I have will save lives. I have HPV, okay? When I was younger, I gave my girlfriend cervical cancer, and this is how it happens. And I almost guarantee you that out of those 4,000 women, 80 or plus percent got it this way. HPV is the same virus that causes warts.
Right.
Okay? I had warts on my hand when I was a little kid. I had them all over my hand. I had them burned off with I don't know what they call it. It's really cold.
Right. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway,
Louise, by the way, tells me she's been digging into this, and apparently HPV cannot be spread by kissing. It requires contact with genitals. And Brent, you might want to go ahead. Finish your story.
I have experience with this because I have HPV. I had warts.
Right.
Warts on my hand, open wart sore, petting contact, which most people think that you can just get it with intercourse. This was petting contact on my hands. I'm not going to go grab
that's enough, Brett. I got the point. And again, neither one of us are experts on HPV, and I understand that there's a whole bunch of different HPV viruses, and this vaccine inoculates against several of them, but not all of them, and that there are different viruses that cause different types of warts. So, but you know, that's not the question. The question is, you know, what should be done about this, given what we know? Nancy in Chicago. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, Tom. I was going to actually say something similar to what you did, that this vaccine does not cover all viruses that have been associated with cervical cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And there have also been some studies that were raised back when Gardasil first hit the market that said that it might in some way in the future increase cervical cancer rates in girls that get it, because they're going to believe that they are inoculated against all of the viruses and may not get pap smears. I don't know if that's something that has panned out over the last 10 years, but people need to understand that if you get the inoculation, you still should get the pap smear.
Okay, but the conservative argument against the vaccine, aside from the anti-vaccine argument and the anti-state argument, is that once girls get this vaccine, then they're going to go wild and crazy having sex with everybody in sight, because they're going to think that they're bulletproof, you know, they're immune to anything.
I don't agree with that,
you know,
but I do think that it might give people a false sense of security that they're actually covered against all forms of the virus that could cause it. And also, in addition, you know, I'm retired now, but I used to be a products liability plaintiff's attorney, and I used to sue drug companies. And one of the problems with drug companies is very often they control everything having to do with the testing that's done on their
and the information that's out there. So don't in other words, take it with a grain of salt. Nancy, thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back in just a minute with more of your calls and some final thoughts for the day. Oh, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
You tell him, Leonard Cohen. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ellen Ratner in the studio with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, what's going on? Big day at the UN.
A big day at the UN. The president addressed the United Nations today. He said there were challenges with Syria, Iran, and North Korea. He said peace was more than an absence of war. It had to do with justice and opportunity. And he said that they are ending the military operations in Iraq, that they are beginning to transition out of Afghanistan. He also cited the overthrow of regimes in Egypt and Libya. He said that they are ending the humiliating grip of corruption and tyranny, and that is being pried open. He called for sanctions on Syria from the Security Council, talked about Yemen and Bahrain, and that there should be elections that are free and fair. He said that the United States will support any transition to democracy. And then he starts to talk about Palestine, saying the peace depends on compromise about people who must live together after the speeches are over. He also said that Iran and North Korea must end their nuclear program, talked about climate change and transforming the economies that need energy to get different kinds of energy. Now, what's so interesting is right afterwards, he met with Prime Minister Netanyahu. He said that peace has to be negotiated, not imposed, that America's commitment with Israel will not waver. Netanyahu said they wanted peace through direct negotiations, that there has to be a state, etc. Now, what's fascinating about all of this is that there is a statehood process. And right now we know that that President Abbas submitted to the Secretary General, or he's planning on submitting, on the 23rd, which is his GA speech to the General Assembly. And he's submitting the application to statehood. That means that it goes to the Security Council. There's no decision that happens for several weeks. And then they create a committee. The Security Council creates this committee. They need 9 votes for and no votes vetoing from the 5 permanent members. The United States and the European Union are now working on others to abstain from this. And they're trying to get, obviously, Germany, France, UK, and perhaps Portugal to abstain. They're also trying to get Nigeria and Bosnia-Herzegovina and maybe one other to abstain. And then the United States would not have to use a veto.
Oh, interesting. So that's very interesting.
You know, right, and so the other thing is
a heads I lose, tails you lose. You know,
exactly. So if they can get enough abstentions so they don't get those 9 votes without the veto, then they can start to put the quartet back in order, which is the United States, United Nations, European Union, and Russia on this, and it avoids a showdown. And Abbas also, he's
gets
made his application
face.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Everybody saves face, and the process actually gets a kick in the butt. It gets moved
exactly.
forward.
Exactly. So they expect that to happen.
That's pretty slick.
The president is also met today, actually. He has many meetings, including with our friend Salva Kiir from South Sudan.
He met
with the prime minister of Japan, and it was not clear from the translation whether the prime minister of Japan was referring to Japan or to the United States or both. He said the economy may enter another recession, but again, he wasn't specific on that front.
Which president said that? Ours?
The prime minister of Japan.
Prime minister of Japan said
yeah,
the economy
our president doesn't say things like that.
Yeah, I was going to say what?
Some other things going on, which is that Agent Orange. It was interesting. I was just in Lubbock, Texas last night, and I was talking to a person who cannot get money from Agent Orange. But today, Eric Shinseki, General Shinseki, who's now the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, said that they have there's an authorization for $2.2 billion to go to 89,000 vets and survivors of vets who have had Agent Orange diseases, and Shinseki has also put cancer and Parkinson's disease as part of that. Anybody who was in Vietnam from 62 to 75 and either worked in Vietnam or the inland waterways and has had claims, or the DMZ zone, which I didn't realize, in Korea between 68 and 71 is eligible.
Because we defoliated that as well.
That's right.
What about the Vietnamese people who were the victims of Agent Orange?
Well, nobody's talking about that so far.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think there was actually some money at one point, but again, I don't
know
how much.
There was a discussion about this a few months ago, actually.
That's right.
I just don't.
We turn into a pumpkin on October 1st, but in about 48 hours.
Because the annual budget rolls around.
October 1st, that's right. And in about 48 hours, they're going to be taking their recess for Jewish holidays, and as you know, they just take recesses. So
they love those holidays.
They love those
all
recesses.
Kinds of holidays.
That's right. And of course, there's various codels to different parts of the world and all that kind of thing. So the question is, what is actually going to happen with the budget? Because is there going to be a continuing resolution? They basically have 48 hours to pull that off.
Now, is the major? I know that a major point of contention is that the Senate wants to pass over $6 billion in relief, disaster relief, and the House only wants to make it 3 and change.
They want to make it exactly half. That's right.
And so
now it looks like what they're going to do is they're going to say, well, they're going to kind of met it out week by week and put it within those few weeks so that when they come back, I think it's October 3rd, Monday, October 3rd.
Have the Republicans in the House come up with any rationale for why they want to give so – we got $36 billion worth of disaster damage. The Senate is saying $6 billion. The Republicans in the House are saying only three.
That's right, about
and,
half.
And it seems to me like they want there not to be more, because the more disaster relief there is, the more people are put back to work, rebuilding roads and houses and things, and they don't want that because that'll help the economy and the president might get reelected.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, there was a bipartisan group that said that any money collected from BP, this just passed a Senate committee today, has to go back into disaster relief, and that was bipartisan.
Oh, that's interesting. But shouldn't that go to the Gulf?
They want that to go to the Gulf, BP disaster relief to the Gulf.
Okay.
So that was done, but you're right. Absolutely. They don't want to put people to work.
Yeah.
I mean, what can I say? Also, Speaker Boehner today spoke to the National Automobile Dealers. He said the president's paying too much attention to his reelection.
Yeah, right. Well, I hope he is, actually. Ellen Renner of the Talk Radio News Service, thank you so much. Coming up tomorrow, what's up with the state of Colorado threatening a 63-year-old leukemia patient over his medication? And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.